This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we look at the FAA NPRM for the Boeing 737 MAX return to service. In other news, Phillips 66 is investing in sustainable fuel for aviation. JetBlue says they have achieved carbon neutrality. The Collier Trophy winner is announced. American Airlines looks poised to eliminate some smaller destinations. And the F-16 fighter jet sale to Taiwan is formalized. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 617 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me this episode is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert.
Hello, everybody. Had a good week. Really liked last week's show. If you haven't listened to it yet, go do it. It was a really good show. But looking forward to tonight after our last Thursday meeting, Max and I had a little problem, so I'm looking forward to a flawless episode because Max West is here and he never screws up.
Yeah. We were bandwidth challenged last Thursday when Dave and I tried to record the UAV Digest, and in the end, we just gave up, and it just wasn't going to happen. So
we're too old for this beep.
Yeah, we are, but we've all got great internet. This evening, we hope Max Trescott, he's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's also, of course, a national CFI of the year and our man on the Cirrus aircraft. Mr. Trescott, how are you?
Hello, Dave and Mike, that's very good.
Oh, thank God. You. Don't you dare.
No, I'm doing great. Thank you. And it's always fun catching up with you folks every week because it's just fun to kid around and have a good time.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and just so you know, folks, from now on, he's no longer going to be Max West. His new call sign is Sunglasses.
It's true. I've had a different pair each of the last three times. It's amazing how many cheap plastic sunglasses you can buy on Amazon as gag gifts. So, guys, I will be continuing to sign in here with a different look for many weeks to come.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God, help us.
Good thing this is audio only.
Well, you get to see me. The audience doesn't, but that's what true. The heck.
All right, well, we're going to jump right into the aviation news from the past week. Are you guys ready?
I'm ready, as long as it's not about the 737 MAX.
Ready. And our first story tonight comes from FAA.gov.
So I think we've mentioned that the FAA has released an NPRM, a Notice of Proposed Rulemaking.
Concerning
the Boeing 737 MAX. It's available for public review, according to the FAA. The FAA has a summary, and what the FAA is proposing is to supersede Airworthiness Directive AD 2018-23-51, which applies to all Boeing company model 737 MAX airplanes. FAA has determined that final corrective action is necessary to address the unsafe condition. This proposed AD would require installing new flight control computer software, or FCC software, revising the existing airplane flight manual to incorporate new and revised flight crew procedures, installing new MAX display system software, changing the horizontal stabilizer trim wire routing installations, completing an angle of attack sensor system test, and performing an operational readiness flight. So that's what they've been looking at. So we'll have links to these things in the show notes. We have the NPRM announcement. We also have the preliminary summary of the FAA's review of the Boeing 737 MAX, which is a 96-page document. It's labeled preliminary. They call this version 1. This is dated August 3rd, 2020. the FAA notes that the document is subject to revision and updating as the FAA completes additional steps in the process of reviewing the Boeing 737 MAX for return to service. Now, there's a number of safety issues, again, related to MCAS here. Seven safety issues identified by the FAA, and they also describe the proposed corrective action, what Boeing needs to do. And we can talk about some of these. The first one is something that I know, Max Trescott, you've raised before, use of single angle of attack sensor. Say the erroneous data from a single AOA sensor activated MCAS and subsequently caused airplane nose down trim on the horizontal stabilizer. And the proposed corrective action is Boeing updated the flight control computer software to eliminate MCAS reliance on a single AOA sensor signal by using both AOA sensor inputs and changing flight control laws to safeguard against MCAS activation due to a failed or erroneous AOA sensor. I mean, this, in some ways, this was kind of the number one issue that many of us have had.
Yeah, I think it was probably the most glaring thing that stuck out of all the many little things. And maybe it's also one of the easiest things for us to understand. And perhaps that's why we zeroed in on it a little bit. But yeah, I think that we were all a little, stunned that apparently the reason they didn't require a second sensor was that the probability of there being a major problem was deemed to be very low. It's like, well, great, it's nice that there's a low probability, but if there's a high consequence, it's still a problem. And I think that's probably what got ignored.
Yes, yes.
Well, you say that that's the one the other issue that we've been fixated on is the implementation of a new system with lack of training. I mean, that clearly not updating the manuals and working on the awful assumption that this is such a rare event, we don't need to train it. It's kind of a really frightening fundamental issue or a culture issue, I think.
Yeah, or things like, boy, you had just a few seconds to figure it all out, and, you may need 100 pounds of pressure with your hand to turn something. It's like, man, could you come up with a worse nightmare scenario? I mean, it seems like they'd created kind of the doomsday machine, which, the doomsday scenario almost never happened, but when it did, man, you were screwed.
Yeah, that was one of the safety items, actually, flight crew recognition and response. A flight data recorder, they said data from both of the accidents show that the flight crews were unable to effectively manage the stabilizer movement and multiple flight deck effects that were that resulted from the single AOA sensor failure. The corrective action says Boeing revised 8 non-normal flight crew procedures and proposed additional training material. The flight crew procedure and proposed training changes provide the pilot additional information to recognize and respond to erroneous stabilizer movement and the effects of potential AOA sensor failures. Another item is, again, this repetitive MCAS commands. They note that when a continuous erroneous high AOA sensor value exists, the MCAS control law uses pilot release of the electric trim switch to reset MCAS activation. Once reset, the MCAS system will make another airplane nose-down stabilizer trim command after 5 seconds. This scenario repeats each time MCAS makes a command and the pilot makes an electric trim command of any duration and releases the trim switch. So we see here Boeing has changed the flight control laws to ensure that MCAS will not command repeated movements of the horizontal stabilizer. The revised flight control laws permit only one activation of MCAS per sensed high AOA event. That's interesting. Any subsequent activation of MCAS would only be possible after the airplane returns to a low AOA state. So I think that sounds like that addresses the issue of this, repeated, nose pitched down scenario that caused problems with those two accidents.
Well, it's great. I mean, I think Boeing has got to be relieved that the end is in sight, and it's been a nightmare for them and for everybody involved, including the FAA. You know, I think they did not come out of this clean either. So, it's just been a bad situation all the way around. Personally, I won't have any qualms flying the 737 MAX afterwards. I think it will probably turn out to be ultimately one of the safest airplanes around, because it will be one of the few airplanes in which they have gone through every aspect of certification with such a fine-tooth comb the second time. So that's good for the flying public.
Yeah, I would agree with that completely. I think that there are probably few aircraft that have been scrutinized to the extent that has been the case here. Now, as far as return to service, there are some actions that have to be completed, according to the FAA. One is completion of all TAB, that's the Technical Advisory Board. That's the independent team of experts that the FAA utilized in this case. But completion of all TAB return to service recommendations and acceptance by the TAB of those completed actions. Also, successful completion by Boeing and acceptance by the FAA of all regulatory requirements, including aircraft design, documentation, training, and maintenance aspects. Another return to service requirement is publication of two notices to FAA inspectors containing national policy on minimum required maintenance program changes and pilot training program changes that relate to the 737 MAX design change. The notices direct FAA maintenance and operations inspectors to mandate the changes to U.S. air carrier maintenance programs and pilot training programs in accordance with applicable U.S. operating rules. And then another condition, the issuance of an AD that will provide specific instructions for steps the FAA deems necessary that owners and operators must take to correct the unsafe condition and to support public confidence. I think public confidence is an important one. But there are some additional prerequisites. One is for those 737 MAX aircraft that have already been delivered. This is kind of interesting. The owner/operator must incorporate all FAA-mandated design changes and maintenance actions. That's for previously delivered airplanes. For any future delivered 737 MAX airplanes, Boeing is required to incorporate the same mandatory actions. Also, all 737 MAX operators must complete all pilot training identified in the revised 737 MAX FSB report.
So do you think the airlines are going to get Boeing to pay for the updates for the already delivered aircraft?
I bet there are some very interesting conversations going on between the airlines and Boeing.
I mean, do we know how many that were actually delivered?
I have a guess just based on what I think, but I don't want to guess.
Well, I think the delivered numbers prior to the shutdown was probably in the few hundreds. I mean, if you think here in the U.S., I think Southwest had the most of them, and I want to say they had 44 of them, which meant the other majors had, 20, 30, something like that. So I figure there were probably roughly 100 here in the U.S., and there might have been 100 outside the U.S. What do you think, Max, about
right? I was thinking 150, a couple hundred, around in that range. And, of course, there are many, many, many more that are built but not delivered.
December 2019, they had delivered 387 aircraft.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's more than I had thought. Okay.
This was 4932 firm orders and delivered 387 aircraft.
Okay.
So, and that's as of December 19th. So it's hard to believe that they were still delivering aircraft at that point.
And, of course, another issue that we talk about is what will the other regulatory agencies around the world do. I think, as we've mentioned many times in the past, most of them would be more inclined to go along with whatever the FAA recommends, but that may not necessarily be the case here. But the FAA does address it. Now, the issue of the CANIC, the Continued Airworthiness Notification to the International Community, CANIC, C-A-N-I-C. The FAA will issue a CANIC for the 737 MAX that provides information to the global aviation community on a comprehensive set of actions that must be taken by owners and operators to ensure a safe return to service. The CANIC will precede the issuance of mandatory continued airworthiness information in the form of an FAA AD. As other civil aviation authorities consider returning the 737 MAX to service in their jurisdictions, the FAA recommends these two things. First, civil aviation authorities with 737 MAX aircraft on their respective registries are strongly encouraged to mandate the pilot training identified in the 737 MAX FSB report as a minimum starting point. And the second one is, each state of registry is responsible for the continued airworthiness and continued operational safety of aircraft on its registry. Accordingly, the FAA will strongly recommend, again, that all states of registry adopt a final FAA AD and mandate the same changes in their own systems. So whether they will do that or will look to do something that's even more strict, that remains to be seen.
Well, I guess that becomes the baseline, right?
Yeah.
For all, I mean, if you're using the aircraft internationally, in order to operate in the United States, you need to have this. Now, should the other countries decide to go beyond that, that's going to be up to them and working with Boeing and those airlines. So it can only get worse. It can't get – I don't think there are going to be any under requirements. So
now just maybe one last point on this topic is that training requirement. And in the preliminary summary, the FAA addresses training enhancements. And it wasn't what I was expecting, actually. It reads, this section of this report will be completed following the review and evaluation of Boeing's proposed training by conducting a Flight Standardization Board, or FSB, and a Joint Operations Evaluation Board. The FAA will assess the effectiveness of the proposed aircraft design changes on pilot training, including evaluation of all proposed flight crew procedure changes. The FAA will conduct this evaluation jointly through the Joint Operations Evaluation Board with international civil aviation authorities. And then the FAA will issue a draft Boeing 737 Flight Standardization Board report documenting the results of the operational evaluation. The report will be posted for public comment. You can subscribe to this information if you want to receive notification when the FAA posts the draft report. So training is, I guess it's being treated as kind of distinct from the design changes and also subject to its own public comment period. It seems that's the way I read this.
That'll be really interesting with the comments. If they're going to do a whole separate training thing, I think that will have more responses to it than the normal, the actual mechanical updates or electronic updates.
So we'll have a link. We'll have several links in the show notes to the preliminary summary, also to the NPRM. We're on regulations.gov. You can go to submit a comment if that's something you would like to do. The deadline for comments on this NPRM is September 21st, 2020. So roughly a month left to do this. I guess it was a 45-day comment period altogether, but that's the deadline. All right, moving on to some other things. Sustainable fuel. Max West, AvWeb has an item about Phillips 66.
They do, and this is in my backyard, or, well, not quite in my backyard, fortunately. Phillips 66 has a large refinery here in Northern California, not too far from San Francisco in Rodeo. Most of the refineries in this area are kind of north and east, mostly north of the city, in a concentrated in a particular area. And they have announced that they are going to be converting this particular refinery over to producing sustainable diesel, gasoline, and jet fuels. And they say the conversion is going to move the refinery from using crude oil to using cooking oils, fats, greases, and soybean oils. They estimate that the Rodeo Renewed project will produce 680 million gallons of sustainable fuel annually, which a lot of interesting comments in here. One of which suggests that in terms of sizes of refineries in the U.S., that's not a particularly large amount. They say the average refinery here does something like 200,000 BD barrels a day, I guess. So anyway, the total amount relatively small, but it is a move that they say is going to move us to help meet the demand for cleaner burning fuel with lower carbon. In the comments here, they also somebody mentions sulfur. I guess that's a process that your refineries have to use to, in some cases, to lower the sulfur content because there are maximum sulfur limits that they can have and delivered to jet fuel. That's one process they won't have to apply to this particular project because, I guess cooking oils and soybeans don't have sulfur in them. So that saves them a little money there.
I was going to say, I don't really want to consume sulfur in my cooking oil.
No, definitely not.
Not healthy frying there, folks.
So one area that I don't feel like I'm really knowledgeable on is the implications of this with respect to the distribution network. Let's just say that they're producing this, almost 700 million gallons a year of sustainable fuel. But what about getting it through the distribution system? And, what are the issues associated with that? I assume you can't just mix it in with everything else, right?
It's a good question. Some of these fuels can be mixed. Some of them, there's a kind of a maximum a percentage of the biofuel that you can use, depending upon, and again, I was just reading down through the comments to pick up, some of these things. Apparently, depending upon which of those different sources, whether it's cooking oil, soybeans, or so on and so forth, some of those sources are going to limit the maximum minimum temperature, I guess the minimum temperature, because if you use those, then you get a gelling of the fuel, which can be a real problem if you're a jet flying up at high altitudes where it's cold. So for some of these sources, apparently they're going to mix it with a ratio of 90% jet fuel to 10% of the sustainable jet fuel. But for other sources, they don't have that gel problem, and I don't recall which source is which. A certain amount of mixing is required and can happen, but I don't know how they're going to deliver it.
I would assume it's being delivered like we would normally get our here in Pennsylvania. We have ethanol mixed in with our petroleum at the gas stations automatically, and it comes pre-mixed in one truck. So I don't think that would be, if they're going to mix it as jet fuel, it's going to get transferred as jet fuel. I don't think they're going to be mixing it on site.
Yeah, now some airports actually have pipelines bringing the fuel in, because you can imagine the number of trucks that you would need to bring into a major airport is huge.
You mean fuel farms? I know a little bit about fuel farms.
Well, tell us.
I know what happens when one of your fuel tanks breaks, which is what actually happened at the base. It's stored in larger volumes on base and then piped out to the flight line. So, you truck in the fuel, at Philadelphia International, the fuel farm is actually on the water, and they bring tankers directly up to the fuel farm, and then the fuel is pumped via pipes across the flight line to where the aircraft get fueled. So, you're still not mixing the fuel at the fuel farm.
But what I wonder is, at the fuel farm, right now, let's say for jet fuel, you know, it's all conventional jet fuel. So now if you're creating a version of jet fuel that's based on cooking oil and soybean oil and all this other stuff, you're not going to put it in the same containment tank, are you? I mean,
why not? You just drain the containment tank. When it's empty, you fill it up with the new stuff.
Yeah, but isn't there a requirement to know, you know, when you're pumping something, if it's a, you know, sustainable fuel or fossil fuel, right? You can't just say, hey, it's all fuel.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You actually have to, I mean, you'll have to label the tank and label whatever the distribution is.
Yeah. You know, so that's what I'm, yeah. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about, you know, the implications to the distribution method for sustainable fuel.
We'll just need a third nozzle for the pumps.
Yeah, and a third tank.
Isn't that true, Max, that jet fuel has a different nozzle than fuel for reciprocal engines because people pump one into the other, and I don't know what the ramifications are of which one goes into what.
But I don't know. It just, to me, it seems like producing the fuel at this soon-to-be reconfigured refinery is not the end of the story. It doesn't seem to me. It seems like there's a lot of logistics to the transportation of that fuel, the storage of that fuel, and the use of that fuel. But I don't know. I guess we have some time to figure it out. Apparently,
anybody Phillips, an expert on biofuels out there, give us a call.
So they say that, this plant conversion by Phillips 66 still requires some approval. But if it is approved, they say that the production would start in early 2024. So few years left. All right, in a related story from Business Wire, JetBlue is the first U.S. airline to commit to and achieve carbon neutrality for all domestic flying. That sounds pretty impressive.
Yeah, definitely. Sounds like they're doing it a variety of different ways, including using some different fuel types like the kinds we were just talking about. One of the things that's interesting and kind of relates to what we were just talking about is that their supplier, Neste, that's N-E-S-T-E, is going to be delivering this fuel to the San Francisco airport via pipeline. So that makes distribution, you know, pretty straightforward there. Initially, I think all of their flights that are going to be using this special fuel are going to be those that originate from San Francisco. And JetBlue does have a fairly strong presence here, but it's certainly a good start for them to figure out how to lower carbon emissions.
So JetBlue is doing this through a lot of carbon offsetting, right? I mean, that's different than using, you know, a different fuel or doing something that reduces the amount of carbon emissions you have in your business. The other way to, you know, claim carbon net neutrality is by these offsets. So this is something that JetBlue has done a lot of. They've worked with something that's called carbonfund.org. They've offset, JetBlue's already offset more than 2.6 billion pounds of CO2 emissions through this carbonfund.org foundation. That group says that they make it easy and affordable for any individual, business, or organization to reduce and offset their climate impact and hasten the transition to a clean energy future. And so how does carbonfund.org do that? Well, they achieve their goals through climate change education, carbon offsets and reductions, and public outreach. So not to sound like, you know, the environmental curmudgeon that I find myself sounding like this episode, carbon offsets, again, it's different than actually reducing the amount of carbon your organization, your company produces. So that means investing in, you know, in other things that have a carbon impact. But, you know, I sometimes the accounting in these things makes me wonder if the overall net real world achievement is as great as the numbers sort of seem to indicate. So anyway, so like I say, not to sound like a curmudgeon, but.
Wow. You're well, I mean, in all fairness, okay, JetBlue is at least doing something.
Yes.
And carbon offset is kind of, I mean, you can't instantaneously change an airline from jet fuel to biofuel or all of the other emissions that are involved with running an airline. I mean, let's face it, airplane tugs burn fuel, you know, your heating things burn fuel. So it's a way, you're right, Max. I don't think it's a one-to-one, right? Mm. But at least it's something. It's acknowledging that there's a problem in doing something.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, unfortunately, it always comes, when that's the case, it comes off as guilt. And, you know, okay, we have to do something. And we're just guilty and we can't, you know, we need to show the world we're doing something, you know. And I don't get that feeling from JetBlue. Now, if it was United, I would have gotten that feeling. But in all seriousness,
By the way, any lawsuit should be directed toward David because I didn't say anything bad about United.
I mean, it wouldn't be an episode if we didn't say anything bad about United.
Oh, sure it would.
No, but in all fair, we joking aside, it's hard to present as a legitimate way of reducing your carbon footprint without there being a air of guilt and not being completely valid, you know. So I'm sort of with you, Max. I get the idea. It's just sort of I'm suspicious of some of the issues involved, you know. It's not like Bombas socks that when you go to online and you buy their socks, for every pair you buy, they directly send to a charity a matching pair.
Yeah.
That's a one-to-one.
I'm wearing Bombas socks right now. And not because I received them as a charity.
And we'd like to thank our other sponsors of the show.
Yeah. Sorry, David. Go ahead.
My socks? Mine haven't arrived yet.
They got mixed up with your glasses.
Okay, yeah. Got it.
But they're
good socks, by the way.
But there, you can see there's a one-to-one.
Yes, yes.
I mean, that's my point. I'm sorry if that's a bad analogy, but it literally, when they say they've sold 2 million socks, they've also say they've given away 2 million socks. So there's an offset there.
But let's be clear. There are two parts to the program here. I mean, the last part of our conversation here makes it sound like it's only a carbon offset program where, hey, they're paying to have trees built in a forest, planted in a forest somewhere, which will, you know, reduce the carbon. There is also another part of the program, which is using sustainable fuel on flights from San Francisco. Yeah. So, there are multiple parts to this program. Collectively, they're saying that they are now finally carbon neutral. And, you know, we should applaud them for that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with that. Yeah, and I don't really mean to, you know, compliment JetBlue, but
no, I was trying to compliment JetBlue. I mean, they're doing something, and it's substantive.
Yeah, yeah, but still, it's the situation is still, you know, I'm crapping all over the earth. You're crapping all over the earth too. Oh, let me help you crap less all over the earth, and I get credit for that. It's like, yeah, okay, except I'm still crapping all over the earth, you know. So, yeah, you're right. You're right. I mean, it's a step, but I just think we shouldn't be, you know, lulled into complacency because everybody starts, you know, defending their, you know, environmental position based on offsets. But that's just a personal opinion. And, of course, we don't have many personal opinions here.
David, you're losing it there.
I know. We need to move on. Hey, I understand there was a winner announced for the Collier Trophy.
This is so totally cool. Now, apparently it was postponed because this was supposed to have happened back in April. Early in the year, probably around February, maybe March, we announced the nine or so different contenders. And we had Launchpad with us on that particular show. And I got everyone here to make a commitment as to who they thought was going to be the winner. And you guys did pretty well.
Did we?
Yeah. You don't recall?
Did I pick the both winner?
You and David picked the winner, but you both hedged your bets. You both said, yeah, it really should be the X37B that wins, but I don't think it could win.
Should have gone with the gut, huh?
Yeah, exactly. You guys were right, but you totally hedged it. Now, I was off. I was wrong. Launchpad and I were both wrong. Launchpad picked the Hubble Space Telescope, and we talked about how it was probably a project that should have been nominated many, many, many years ago for the Collier Trophy. I picked the Stratolaunch Carrier because I just think great, big, huge, honking airplanes are cool. But I also get that that may not have been as revolutionary technology. Just because it was big, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that it brought new cutting-edge kinds of things. So, you know, I think the X-37, the space plane, which has been in orbit for thousands of days, and I guess its record was, 780 days or something like that in space, you know, a self-managed, you know, spaceship. Pretty darn cool. So congratulations to the Air Force and Boeing for winning the Collier Trophy this year with the X-37B.
Now, if we only know what it does.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. It's cool. It's innovative. But
there's another one up there right now, and we still don't know what it does. But it's a baby space shuttle, and it's really cool. And you know what, folks? It's a drone. Oh, did I say that out loud? I'm sorry.
The most interesting, to me, at part of this AvWeb article. Boy, we're getting a lot of AvWeb stuff this episode. It includes a list of who's on the selection committee,
right?
Several of whom have been guests on this podcast in the past.
One is even a co-host.
Well, I wasn't on the committee this year, but I have been in the past.
Yeah.
Great process. But, very enjoyable.
Yeah. It's a really interesting list. I mean, it covers a lot of Richard Abilafia is on there, and Air and Space Museum leader is on there. And it's just an interesting group of people. I think Patty Wagstaff is in that group, too. Do I remember correctly? But anyway, it's in the article if you'd like to see what it takes to be the caliber required to determine who the Collier Trophy winner is. You can take a look.
But congratulations to the U.S. Air Force. Now just tell us what it does.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
And more importantly, let us know if it's carbon neutral.
That's right. Yeah.
How many trees were saved to put the X-47 in orbit? The X-37 in orbit.
Just trying to tie all these stories together, guys. You know.
Well, you know, it's in space, no one knows your carbon footprint.
Yeah. I'll have to think
moving
about
right
that.
Along.
From CNBC, American Airlines prepares to drop some service to smaller cities as expiration of federal aid nears. Of course, as we all know, under the terms of this $25 billion federal aid package, airlines have to maintain minimum levels of service and employment through September 30th, 2020. Well, September 30th, 2020 is rapidly approaching. And American Airlines says that they're going to discontinue flights from some small and medium-sized cities after this September 30th expiration, although they have not identified those cities yet.
And I think that's part of the natural ebb and flow of this industry. You know, if you look over, you know, many, many, many decades, you look at the cycles, you know, the economy goes down, airlines lay off pilots, they cut service to cities, and it's always the small towns that end up without flights. And unfortunately, the people who live in those towns end up having to drive an hour or more, sometimes a couple hours, to get to the next closest city where they can hop on an airliner. So, yeah, it's the small towns in particular that are going to suffer. This, of course, article just talks about American Airlines. I think we can anticipate that most of the major procedures will do the same thing. And perhaps some cities will still retain service, but will not have as many carriers service them. But there are bound to be towns that just have no service left at all, which is, you know, unfortunate for the people that live there.
Yeah. Now, at the same time, there is some support in Congress for additional federal payments. In other words, something that would extend this beyond the September 30th deadline, maybe into the spring, actually. But as we also know, the Congress hasn't really gotten its act together in terms of coming up with the legislation that would make that happen. But there is some support for it. If our elected representatives are hearing from airlines that there's going to be huge layoffs and decreases in service after this expiration September 30th, maybe that'll encourage them to take some action.
I think it probably won't, and I think the airlines are bracing for the cuts are coming. If they are thinking this far ahead for planning, you know, there's definitely a drop dead date and a go forward date. So I can't imagine that, like Max Trescott said, there are going to be cities that lose service. And correct me if I'm wrong, but way back in the day, we had some of this, and I believe there is a legislation that allows or requires certain levels of towns to have air service. And I just can't remember what it was. And this is one of those times I wish I had Dan Webb with us. But so I'm wondering if that will become a factor that, you know, the airlines will want to pull out, but this airport requires X amount of service.
I think there still are some subsidies in place that make what would otherwise be unprofitable routes still be carried by some of the airlines. I think that program is probably smaller than it used to be. But to your point about future stimulus packages from Congress, you know, if they do indeed do another form of stimulus, it just strikes me that retaining service to small towns probably won't be super high on their list of, you know, things that need to be accomplished with that stimulus bill. So that's why I'm inclined to believe that there will be towns that lose some service. I think that the political will is going to be more toward, you know, how do we help people, you know, stay employed and stay fed versus how do we keep airline service to small towns.
In all fairness, if an airport loses service, there's a loss of jobs and a loss of revenue there also. So, there's a whole infrastructure on the ground besides in the air. So it's untenable no matter what we do.
Do you think that if this does come to pass and many small and medium-sized towns or some number of them lose service, do you think that would be lost for good? Or do you think 3 years down the road, 5 years down, 10 years down, something in the future would cause the economic viability of those routes to return? Or do you think they'd be lost forever?
I think most of them will eventually get service back again. I don't think it's going to be, you know, 3-4 years. I think the cycle of small towns, you know, winning service and losing service is much longer than that. And I think they often go, you know, without service for, you know, 7, 8, 9 years until the economy has picked up enough to the point where airlines are looking for new places to go. And then they start adding service again. We might find that as the technology changes, that some of that service might be provided by, you know, different kinds of aircraft. You know, the problem with the small cities is they're just isn't a lot of embarkments. There aren't a lot of passengers from them. And so, for example, some of the hybrid electric aircraft that we've talked about might actually be a better fit if, they can serve these towns with newer electric aircraft that would be, you know, short haul and, fewer than 50 passengers. And speaking of employee layoffs, there was an announcement just about a day or so ago that said, at McCarran Airport in Las Vegas. They currently have plans to lay off 940 employees in different food service companies there come October 1st. Wow. So, yeah, there's that's just one airport. So this is a big deal.
You know, it's funny, Max, you talk about different aircraft. And growing up, one of the things that I used to watch at Philadelphia International was there was airlines like Allegheny, and they flew little tiny turboprops that, you know, they flew them to the airport. You know, maybe there is a market again for Dash 8s and Twin Otters and, you know, a smaller infrastructure and for those airports. And not every airport needs a jet service, but something like a turboprop. We've got region jets and all that other stuff, but you can see that maybe we need to go back to restructuring the way airlines work. And then you get new airlines or airlines like Allegiant, you know, where they don't fly to the big airports. They fly to other airports. Back in the day when Value Jet was around, there's always a way to fill a market. It may not be the way we normally think of it, but it may be a way to satisfy that market.
I think you're right. I think that we could see a resurgence of turboprops. You know, the reason most of the airlines got away from them was because passengers preferred quieter, faster jets, and yet the turboprops were much more economical. So I could see the airlines providing more turboprop service. Just in the last week, I remember reading about one major company, maybe it wasn't a major company, I don't recall. Somebody was producing a new turboprop for the airlines. I remember at the time thinking, well, that's kind of interesting. The trend has been away from that. So I was kind of surprised to see that somebody had plans to bring out a new turboprop.
Well, and what De Havilland Aircraft up in Washington State has got the license to produce the Dash 8 and again, you know, so maybe it's not a full size, you know, Dash 8, but maybe they go back to building. I mean, they're building Twin Otters. Maybe they go back to building a successful aircraft like the Dash 8 that was designed just for that, you know, to get from the smaller airports to the bigger ones, you know. So
what's old again is new again. Kind of funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the economies tend to be kind of resilient. So I mean, we've certainly seen a major perturbation. I don't know what's worse than a perturbation, but
excuse me, we don't use that language around here.
So companies get creative. New companies, new businesses, new industries form, and maybe all of this mess that we're in, this disaster, precipitates the innovation that brings us new products and new services. Yeah. But anyway, from Bloomberg, U.S. formalizes F-16 jet sale to Taiwan with China tensions high. David, apparently we're still selling F-16s internationally.
Why not? Everybody wants them. The F-16, the Lockheed Martin has got the F-16 and the fact that they've moved the program from Fort Worth to, I believe, South Carolina, and is still a producing aircraft. And for a lot of countries, it's a fourth generation fighter that they can afford. In this case, it's a non-threatening fourth generation fighter because Taiwan is still technically going to be part of China eventually.
Some would argue with that, though.
But. Well, right, exactly. So it's a high-tension area, and providing updated F-16s for defense of the island is probably more of a political story than an aviation story. Hmm. It's kind of a way to look at it as a spit in the eye of China kind of thing, you know, that we're constantly in economic struggles with them. So this is one of those the tensions in the Pacific Ocean right now are high. You know, China is becoming a world superpower and is building a infrastructure in the South Pacific. This is another way to reinforce our allies in that area, specifically Taiwan, with the F-16s. In all fairness, they're probably really not a threat to China, but it's a way to promote the island and keep their infrastructure current without being overt. Now, if we sent something like an F-35 in there, all hell would break loose. But the F-16s, I think the Chinese will protest a bit too much about, but not do anything about. So it's a safe, it's a safe way of reinforcing the infrastructure on Taiwan.
So you think this sale will fly under the radar?
Yeah, no, I guarantee you it won't be flying under any radar.
That's good.
It's going to be a really large blip on a lot of radars. If the Chinese don't protest enough, the current administration will rub salt in the wound with it. So, I mean, it's like I said, it's far more a political story than it is a real aviation news breaking story. F-16s are everywhere. They're kind of like the 21st century Big 21s. They don't seem to go away. And I don't see them going away for any time soon. I think the production run is at least another 5 or 6 years at minimum that Lockheed Martin can get out of the aircraft. So,
all right. And Morocco's buying 24 of the F-16s as well, I guess.
Yeah. It's, like I said, they're equivalent to MiG-21s in the 70s and 80s. They are inexpensive and effective, and they're available, you know, either surplus ones from other countries that have upgraded or ones coming straight off the line. It's a very effective aircraft, you know, and we'll see what lasts longer, the F-15 or the F-16 as far as Air Force 70s fighters production goes, because I think they're both in competition that we're going to be seeing them around for a long time, new ones coming off the lines, etc.
Yeah.
Here's my theory on this. Typical government spending, you know, the end of the year is coming up. You got to use that money or lose it. It's like, oh, let's buy some F-16s.
Yeah, well, the Air Force isn't buying them. But Lockheed's okay with that because they'd rather have them buy F-35s. But that being said, I mean, Taiwan does have a formidable Air Force, and we've supported it for a very long time. So it's not surprising, but it is a mitigating transfer, not necessarily a frontline transfer.
Well, that's good, because we certainly don't need any more global tension. So I'm happy to hear that, yeah, you think that this is not going to raise too much angst, yeah, with that sale. So that's good.
Many years ago, I did visit the F-16 line, David, which was probably the longest building that I was ever inside of. I mean, I was at one end of that thing and looking as far as the eye, because, well, you couldn't see the far wall of the place. And it almost looked like it had its own, you know, different weather system down there at the other end, is the end that you were at. But
probably did. I've yeah. seen hangars that have had different climates at different parts of the hangar. So
it was, well, the best part about that was a business trip, of course. And the best part about that is the hotel where I was staying was pretty close to the plant, and I was awakened that morning a little bit earlier than I had anticipated waking up, but it didn't matter because I was awakened by three F-16s flying past my window at low altitude, doing what I don't know, but they sounded great, and it definitely woke me up.
Oh, and speaking of really big buildings, it's funny, when I remember large buildings, I remember visiting the GE engine plant, which is just south of Cincinnati. And my recollection of that was, you know, the building was so big, people were using bicycles to get around inside of it.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever been to that plant?
No, because they were a competitor. So,
well, you mean they wouldn't let you come in and take a look around?
Are you kidding me?
Well, yeah, you know, and that brings to mind my smart aleck comment that that I was saying it before my lights flickered, which was you said the F-16s that went by your window were amazingly and they sounded great. And I commented that they were probably the other engine company.
They could have been.
That's funny. And I forget, the engines that are made south of Cincinnati, is that for the military or commercial or which GE engines are made there?
Isn't that the locomotive engines factory?
Oh, I thought they made aircraft engines at that factory. Well, it's only been like 35 years since I've been there, so I don't remember.
What's up with the geeks? Well, you know, I have nothing new aviation-wise, actually. Having been in travel status for a couple of weeks here, but I did want to report on our listener poll from last week. You'll recall that we asked, how do you predominantly listen to the Airplane Geeks podcast? And, I mean, there's nothing particularly actionable here, but I just was intrigued to see how you all listen to us. And if you're interested in the results, 25% listen through the Apple Podcasts app, 20% through the Overcast app, which is a very popular one. That was followed by another popular podcast app, Pocket Casts, a little over 13%. And then the Google Podcasts app came in at 10%. Then the numbers drop. Podcast Addict, a little over 8%. Stitcher, 6.7%. AntennaPod, 5%. I don't even know what AntennaPod is. I hadn't heard about that one.
No, I haven't heard that one either.
And but we have a couple of folks listening to that. And then from there on, it was just one each of BeyondPod, CastBox, Downcast, iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, and iCatcher. So it's a very, it's an unscientific test because we asked the question at the end of the show, and only 5 days have elapsed for this data that I just reported on. So I think those are probably from our, Uber listeners, people that get through the whole episode within the first 5 days of it being published. But we thought we'd do, we'd see how it goes. Maybe we'd have a poll a week, and we're looking for this really easy, fast, simple things that don't take up a lot of your time. But they should be things that are related to aviation, the topic of this podcast. So we didn't really come to a consensus on what the next question should be. So I just invented the next question, which will be for this week's Airplane Geeks listener poll. And that'll be, what question should we ask Airplane Geeks listeners? What would you like to hear Airplane Geeks listeners opine on? And you'll be able to submit your request, your ideas at airplanegeeks.com/poll, P-O-L-L. And again, it'll be just a simple, quick, what would you like us to ask the Airplane Geeks audience? And keep it non-political.
So we can't talk about tankers and stuff like
that. Yeah, tankers are out. Probably 737 Max is out. Maybe not.
Can't talk about United either. That would be political. No,
right. And we had a little very quick, little under 3 minute report from our reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. He found an FBO that he thought was just off the charts, he said. So let's listen to what Launchpad discovered at this FBO.
Hey, Airplane Geeks. Last week I got to fly up to Colorado Springs and got a look into how the other side lives, and I want to tell you about a great FBO. Cutter Aviation in Colorado Springs did a fantastic job for me. They made rental car reservations, hotel reservations, dinner reservations. I flew in. The marshal was on the ramp waiting for me, guided me in, parked my aircraft right in front of their doors. As I was doing shutdown, they bring the rental car to your airplane, open the trunk, leave the engine running so the air conditioner is cooling off the car. I moved my bags from the airplane, the 6 feet to the rental car, signed the documents, got in the car, was handed a strip map on how to get to my hotel reservations. Wow, what incredible service. At the end of my trip, I go back into their well-upholstered FBO, which looks like a hunting lodge, including a great, gorgeous elk's head over the fireplace. Yeah, they have a fireplace in their lobby. Use their pilot resource center. Pay my bills for fuel, which were very reasonable. They did not charge me any ramp fees. And then you get to drive your car all the way out to the aircraft, move your bags from the trunk directly into the airplane. One of the ramp guys takes your rental car away and returns it back. And you get into the airplane and fly away. This is the flying we were promised. No TSA, no parking lot, no terminal, no waiting for boarding. Leave your shoes on. This is why you should get your pilot's license and start flying your own airplane. If you're a passenger and not a pilot, you just drive out to the airplane and get in, and they take the rental car away. Now I understand why first class air travel is diminishing, because if you can NetJet, oh my gosh. Qatar Aviation in Colorado Springs is made to look like a pine lodge in the mountains. It has this incredible wood sculpture on the front of it that was just perfect. It's a life-size bear. The sculpture's over 6 feet tall, looking longingly at the airplanes while holding an airplane. It's just too perfect. Big, big shout out to Qatar Aviation. If you get a chance to fly in, it's worth it to stop there. This is your Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved.
So I guess one of the features of this FBO is the carving of the bear holding an airplane out front. And Launchpad sent us the photo of that, so we'll have that in the show notes. It's pretty amusing. The bear's got a nice grin on its face, which is very welcoming, I'll say.
I was thinking it was actually a drone that he was holding, but maybe I'm wrong.
It could be a fixed wing. Well, it's not a Phantom, that's for sure.
Well, and I think FBOs try and do things that set them apart from other FBOs. And so, yeah, that's just kind of cute and distinctive. It's nice to have something that people will remember and hopefully come back to your FBO to buy gas the next time.
Well, and you had that experience recently, Max, at that one in Colorado, right? That
was in Pueblo. Yes, exactly.
Wow. Wow. I was paying attention to that night.
Yeah. A lot of airports will have multiple FBOs. And so it's not typically the owner of the airplane that decides. It's typically the pilot, flying the jet. And, you know, those bills when you're filling up a business jet can be pretty large. And so, yeah, they do whatever they can to get pilots to remember them and come back to their particular FBO.
All right. Micah sent us a story. I kind of like this. This is amphibious assault ship USS Essex carries load of gorgeous World War II warbirds to Hawaii. It's from The Drive. And so this Navy ship, it's a WASP-class amphibious assault ship, the USS Essex. And it served as a transport ship bringing these World War II-era warbirds. And it included the P-51 Mustang, a B-25 Mitchell bomber, a number of others. But this was all in association with some events that are commemorated the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II. But one of the things I liked about this article is it is loaded with gorgeous photographs of these warbirds. I didn't even read the article pretty much beyond the first paragraph or two. Just look at the photos. It's worth it just for that.
Yeah, particularly like the Catalina flying boats. They've got two of them. I mean, that's a fairly rare bird and kind of fun to see those being hoisted out of the water and up onto the ship.
So we'll have a link to that article in The Drive in the show notes. We heard from our friend John Mollison, and he says we should know about an event coming up featuring Tuskegee Airman General Charles McGee. John says he's way more than just a survivor of the Great Depression, single-parent family, racial segregation, and three wars. He's a powerful, positive influencer for today. So on Wednesday, September 2nd, General McGee will be interviewed live as part of the Old Guys and Their Airplanes debrief series. So John says this is going to be a historic interview, wonderful and especially rare opportunity for anyone to learn history from someone who was up close and personal with some of our nation's most important historical moments. Now, he notes that General McGee served in World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War, accumulating an astounding 409 combat missions. But he's got civilian service as well, honors including the nation's highest civilian award, the Congressional Gold Medal. And he is 100 years old, still going strong, still an active role model to our youth, promoting his mantra of personal success, which is perceive, prepare, perform, and persevere. So this live interview is free. It's open to the public. And they're really encouraging teachers and group leaders to tune in. So the September 2nd interview, 2020, with General McGee, in that vein, will be conducted during school time. So it's 9 a.m. Pacific time, 10 a.m. Mountain, 11 a.m. Central, and noon Eastern. So something that educators can take advantage of. So we have a link to the portal for the September 2nd interview, and we'll have that in the show notes. Be sure, you know, if you only go to the show notes for that, it would make us happy. So you can learn more about it there. We want to thank John for letting us know about it. And John, of course, he's been on the show before. Is the man behind oldguysandtheirairplanes.com. He's also at johnmollison.com, M-O-L-L-I-S-O-N. John continues to do some fantastic stuff.
And if you haven't heard General McGee, even though that sounds really funny to me anymore, speak, he's phenomenal. I've interacted with him a couple of times, and he is every bit as impressive. And if you remember it's hard to believe this year, our Super Bowl, the coin toss was done by General McGee. After he had gotten his honorary promotion to general, he was for a very, very long time to a lot of us, it's Colonel McGee, and it's kind of strange to say General McGee, but he's earned every award and honor he's gotten and then some. So And at 100, he's sharp as a tack. So it'll be a really good interview.
That's just amazing to me. 100 years old.
I hope for his sake that an honorary promotion to general comes with full back pay as well.
I believe it did, believe it or not. I think it's
really?
Did.
Yeah, seriously. I mean, that would be a nice bump in the pension. So I think that's totally cool.
Wow. Yeah, I thought you were kidding. Yeah.
Well, I was half kidding, but I was also thinking it was possible that they did that. I mean, that's that would be a nice move.
You think we'll be doing this podcast when we're all 100 years old and sharp as a tack?
I don't know, but I'm hoping to get an honorary promotion before we're done with this.
Well, you know what? If you guys are doing the show at 100, the odds of me making 100 and you still guys being on the show, I don't see that happening.
Well, and of course, you know, think about all the changes in technology that happened in our lifetime. And we could have started the show on 8-track tapes. You know? Yeah. What technology will supplant a podcast 30, 40, 50 years from now?
It'll be artificial intelligence, Max Flight.
Yeah.
There you go. We'll have you
AI.
We'll have you preserved as computer voice generated thoughts on engines.
Okay, that's a scary thought. All right. Well, we're going to wrap up this episode. We want to thank you for listening. We want to thank you for writing into us. We received a lot of listener email that we didn't have the opportunity to get to this episode, but we really appreciate hearing from you all. Don't forget our poll at airplanegeeks.com/poll, P-O-L-L. And just generally, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. show notes for this episode. We have a redirect. You can go straight there. That's with airplanegeeks.com/617. And of course, we're on email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. David Vanderhoof, when you're not at the American Helicopter Museum, where do we find you?
You can find me on our Slack listener team. And by now, if you're a regular listener, you know how to do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And of course, you can find me on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and that other show that, if technology prevails, we might be able to do this week, called the UAVDigest.com.
That's right. And Max Trescott, how do we find you?
You can find me on 8-track tapes anywhere 8-tracks are available.
Did you used to have 8-track tapes? I did.
I had one of the oddest things. It was an 8-track tape recorder. It was something my father had
purchased.
That's
unusual.
Yeah, it is. I didn't know many people with those. And I had a tape. Those ran, about 45 minutes? And I put, maybe 12 songs or however many you could fit on it. And I used to play that over and over again.
So, well, what I had Journey Escape on 8-track.
Oh, yeah.
And I can't I don't remember. And to this day, I hear it, but the track changed in the middle of the song.
Hmm.
And when I hear that song today, I keep getting screwed up because it doesn't have the click in the middle of the song.
Hey, aviation trivia for you. Mm. What's an aviation connection to 8-track tape?
Isn't there something that uses that as like a data tape or something?
I could be wrong. I think it was invented by Learjet.
Yeah,
the inventor of the Learjet invented the 8-track tape, or at least he did a lot of production of them. I think he invented it.
It was funny because the other thing I saw this week that was really interesting was the fact that the Boeing 747-400 still uses 3.5 floppy disks to upload data. It was sort of like, wow, cool, dude.
Yeah, and they said the Defense Department had just stopped using 8-inch floppies on one of their aircraft, which is, that's amazing. I mean, 8-inch floppies, those things, went out of use pretty much in the early 80s. So it's pretty amazing. Well, so much for the history segment here.
Well, I was going to say, and for all of you youngins who have to Google all of this
that's
stuff.
That's right, exactly. All right. So when I'm not on 8-track tape, I am at the Aviation News Talk podcast. This week, our show, episode 159, is on how to get a pre-flight weather briefing and also the other pre-flight actions required by 91.103, the stuff that you have to do before you jump into an airplane. And you can reach me at aviationnewstalk.com. Click on contact at the top of the page.
Great. And you can find me, Max Flight, on LinkedIn at the UAVDigest.com with David, also with Mary Kirby, talking about the passenger experience at PaxXPodcast.com. In fact, we're getting ready to record a new episode in, I think, a week or so. And, of course, you can find me, along with all of us, at the Airplane Geeks listener team. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.
So let's listen to what Launchpad discovered at this FBO.
We can't hear you.
If you're listening to it, Max, we're not hearing it.
I can hear it. I thought I had this problem fixed.
Well, you looked like you were enjoying it.
I was.
It was fantastic. Could you at least lip sync the episode.
We could read lips. That's how we could
even
do it.
I tested it out. All right.
You must have seen us going like this, right?
No, because no, I don't have...
He's self-engrossed. He's just, right? It's like...
He was in the zone. We're trying to signal you.
Yeah, because I didn't have the Squadcast tab up. I'm looking at the... All right. Maybe let me turn the volume
that explains
up.
Why you can never tell what we're doing.
All right, that's right. All right, we're going to do the low-tech version. I'm going to hold the phone.